I have the good fortune today to speak with a Jamaican of some note. I'm quite impressed with the simple fact that I have a greater grounding in appreciating something that I've always had a consciousness for, that we too are people of right, we too are people vested in the struggle. To know as a student at the University of the West Indies that years before I ever dreamt of setting foot on the campus, Martin Luther King Jr. came there. And now to meet somebody who was instrumental in bringing him here to Jamaica for that event in 1965, a speech that has been played on this program, Connections, is indeed for me an awesome pleasure. I speak to a gentleman who will introduce himself.
I am Dr. Anthony Allen. I'm a psychiatrist and consultant in wellness and also church-based whole person health ministries.
Take us back to 1965, sir. Having Martin Luther King Jr., who had just come off of, among other things, leading a phenomenal struggle for the rights of colored people, black people in the United States, and pretty much one could argue all of humanity within the United States, winning the Nobel Peace Prize. What was it like to even think of bringing Martin Luther King Jr. here and of having him here?
I think for us on the committee, it became very important that he be here. Because it's our duty and was our duty on that committee to facilitate a worship experience for the campus and the wider community that was meaningful and true to the faith. And at that valedictory service, at that time, with the ferment of the 60s, both in Jamaica and the US, it was important for me to have someone there who integrated faith and the human struggle, especially the struggle of the people of color. So I don't want to make any big claims, but with that burden, I humbly made a suggestion to the committee that he be invited to preach at the service. This was accepted, and the rest is history.
Well, sir, Martin Luther King Jr. in the pantheon of the people who struggle for right is a rock star today. Has a whole day dedicated to him, and we are fortunate that we will be playing this interview on that day. But in 1964, 1965, who was he really?
He could have been seen to some extent as a controversial, as a who is this guy type of person, especially before he got his Nobel Prize. It was a lot of struggle, and I think many people perhaps didn't fully understand. And I felt it was important for him to be understood in Jamaica. And I think therefore that when he got his Nobel Prize, that was an opportune time because he was validated indeed by the world and the international intelligentsia. So it was much easier for us to accept him. And I think indeed when he spoke to us on that valedictory service, that was the 20th of June 1965, we received of the measure of the man, the measure of his vision, and the measure of his purpose, and we were all blessed and inspired.
One could argue, as a country that has produced Marcus Garvey, that essentially, with such a front runner, Jamaica would be the natural home to welcome a man like Martin Luther King Jr. But people will also remember that Marcus Garvey didn't die here. He had to leave Jamaica because it wasn't exactly a hospitable place for him after his return from the United States. Could you paint a picture as to the social climate of the time in Jamaica in 1965, certainly as it regarded a consciousness for black people and their struggles globally?
Well, Jamaica is a place of paradox. It's a place of great ferment, a great consciousness, you know, and we have led the world. in consciousness through, you know, people like Usain Bolt, Bob Marley, just to mention a few, and all our athletes and musicians and, you know, any field of endeavor, you name it, Jamaicans are there, highly creative, conscious people. It was necessary for Martin Luther King to come to Jamaica for one reason, that we still have the fortune of our country being run by people of color. You go to the banks, at least certainly in his time, it wasn't that, you know, but people of color are around, ostensibly running everything. But to be in a country where people of color were the majority as against the minority in the U.S. was a life-changing experience for him. And I think that was part of his experience which began to help him to move beyond the black struggle in the U.S. to look at the global struggle of poverty and need for education and employment and the becoming of all people of the world. That was unfortunate for him in the sense, because when he began to talk about money and poverty, that was when he became a highly endangered species, you know. But though Jamaica was helpful for him, as he said, we are still in a place, and I think U.S. is in that place too, when we look at what's happening with the leadership of the U.S. and determination of Congress to stymie anything he can contribute because he's a man of color. You know, when you look on that, and even in Jamaica, there's still a locked battle between the progressive movement of the masses of Jamaican people of color, you know, and the interests, the economic and class interests that want to maintain sway at our expense. It is still a locked battle because in Jamaica, the majority of our young people are not properly educated. In Jamaica, the majority of our people do not enjoy adequate health care. The majority of our people in Jamaica, in many ways, are still not considered as people who are respected citizens to enjoy all the benefits of our citizenship as a first-class person in Jamaica. We are just like the people of color in the U.S. Our young black men are an endangered species, both in terms of education, in terms of family life, in terms of police brutality, etc. You know, so we are still locked in the struggle. The unfortunate thing is that we have a kind of hypnosis, or we are hypnotized to believe that because we speak about out of many one people, that, you know, we are made invisible because one people includes the other ethnic groups. But Jamaica is, you know, over 96% people of color. Jamaica is here because of the Middle Passage. Our destiny as Jamaica depends on the destiny of people of color and the destiny of Africa. And we have lost that because it is politically incorrect to speak about slavery. It's politically incorrect to speak about blackness. It's politically incorrect to speak about, you know, self-determination as people of color in Jamaica. So it's a paradox. It comes out in our music, comes out in Rasta, comes out in reggae. It even comes out in our sports, where we can sing it, we can do it, you know, but in the political sphere, can we say it?
We are in the 50th year of the good doctor's visit to Jamaica. Would you, the younger man you were then, believe that your newly independent Jamaica in 2015, in the 21st century, you could be making the kind of pronouncements you're making now, speaking to or challenges to healthcare or challenges to education of a populace. Do you believe if you took yourself back to 1965, the hopes and dreams you had for your young country at the time, could you have seen what you're seeing today then?
I think that in a sense, yes, because what Martin Luther King did for me, because one of the things he spoke about was, you know, loving the white man. And he admitted that, you know, it was hard to like whites who were oppressing us. But we had a mandate from God to love. And that made a very big difference for me. And he speaks about his book, Strength to Love, that we have that mandate to love. And love involves non-resistance. And he also made a point that the oppressor is as much a victim as the oppressed, and that he needed to be redeemed, he needed redemption, you know. And I think with that type of perspective, it means that we don't have to be in a battle, we don't have to be in a war, but that we have to speak the truth. And that is why he was killed, you know. But we still have that to speak the truth. As I said earlier, we can sing, we can do as Jamaicans, but to say, you know, we still need to call out the issues. And he also spoke about the fact that, you know, that even a street sweeper, you know, is a person of dignity. And he said, you know, if it falls to our luck to be street sweepers, sweep the streets like Raphael painted pictures, like Michelangelo carved marble, like Shakespeare wrote poetry, and like Beethoven composed music, sweep the streets so well that all the hosts of heaven and earth would pause and say, here lived a great street sweeper. That to me was speaking about we as black people, we must move from being considering ourselves as owned to being owners. So if we have a broom, we own that broom. We own the ability to sweep the streets with excellence and dignity. And that meant a lot to me. You know, the smaditization, the somebodytization, as he himself referred to, of the average, so-called average Jamaican. There's a lot as we have, and as persons of color globally, a lot that we have. Africa has all the natural resources of oil and metals, and you know, we have our culture in Jamaica. We still have land all over the place. We have a lot, but we don't feel that we own it. You know, we have talent, we have potential, but we still live as if we are owned. And therefore, the smallest, so-called smallest of us is big, just like everybody else. So we need to get that mentality. We are now owners. How can we live and behave like owners and stop acting as if we are owned by a political party? Because the national movement in Jamaica, which was spurred by people like O.T. Flerkoff, Norman Manley, Bustamante himself, and other people like Tom Gervin and, you know, Rex Nettleford and Louise Bennett and other people in various endeavors who helped to build this country. We became divided by the party system. And that division was a tool of the colonial forces that used the specter of communism, you know, to divide the political movement in Jamaica, the national movement. And so our people now, who are beginning to think about owning, moving away from labor oppression, we're one of the earliest countries in the world to have universal adult suffrage way back in 1944, one of the earliest. We were well poised, but now our people are still living, the mass of our people, as being owned by one party and owned by another party, you know, and owned by dons in the ghetto. You know, instead of being owners.
I think if you take yourself back to that room of the 400 graduates,
yes,
400 or so graduates that were there then, the kingdom was largely yours. The Jamaican kingdom was largely yours. The people coming out of the university at around that time. The belonging of the Caribbean was to you, your generation. If it is, this was so empowering for you, no doubt for others in that room. How did or did it not create that kind of a base? Were the spoils so immediate, so apparent, so real, that essentially it was for self-benefit that came very quickly or relatively quickly, that the rest of the message, the liberation that would come from him and from what Marcus Garvey had said and others before had said, that we now find ourselves in this place?
It continues to be a kind of duality. I believe that on the positive side, many of the persons who were in that chapel, if somebody were to probably do a survey, you'd find that many of those people did go forth and make a significant contribution. You know, people who would have become academics, people would have been in the field of medicine and law and other areas, teachers and education, and there are many people who have contributed significantly from that 400. So we could measure the significant contribution. So I think we have no doubts about that, right? Because you were UWI at that time, the fact that he could have come there and what people, he was so moving to people, meant that there was a readiness, and many people, as I have said, have contributed. But at the same time, I think it comes back to the matter of spirituality on one hand and economics on the other. I think that the church, as I understand it, needs to be a global church which represents the totality of humanity. But unfortunately, the church, you know, the most segregated hour in the United States is 11 a.m. on a Sunday. In America, you also find on a Sunday morning that you can look at the stratification in the society by looking at the different churches. You know, you go to the established churches, you know, the Anglican and the Baptist and, you know, those established churches and Roman Catholic and so on. And you come to the evangelical churches and then you come to Pentecostal and you come to revival. You know, you can still see that it's changing and people are coming much more together now. But there is still that kind of divide. And it's growing, it's changing. But as a church, we still model our worship from the old English traditions. We have had people like Barish Evans, Father Holong, and others, you know, who have created our own religious music, and that has been continuing. We have more of the drum in our churches and so on. So that is Noel Dexter, is another person. So that is but we have a lot more work to do, where we can present a transforming Christ, who is relevant to people of color. And Christ is not, he was a Jew, you know, he was not a white man, right? And he will spend time in Egypt, and that may have influenced him significantly, as God would have it. So we still have a task of the church reaching out to marginalize the church, having more of a theology of the Caribbean and a theology relating to the liberation, spiritual, intellectual and holistic liberation of people of color specifically, right? And we can see ourselves as part of, you know, the redeemed and the wider church and so on, but we have a particular journey and God has something to say to us and about us in our specific situation. But that challenge is still before us, A lot of younger people, I think, are losing interest in the church in Jamaica, right?
If you take me back to 1965 and who was in that room, you've spoken to the farmer class. One gets a sense that my high school, St. Mary High School, had just come into being 1960 thereabouts. It was part of Norman Manley's expansion of who could get education, being seen as a direct leg up for the small man, so to speak. Free education, 1972 or 73 thereabouts, an announcement of Michael Manley, the son of Norman Manley, to essentially, I guess, open the gates even more to the lumpen to get into the middle class and the upper middle class, or the middle class, as per Peter Tosh. When you look again at this room that you really helped to, well, inspire by bringing Dr. King here, who was in that room? Where did your peers come from in terms of the strata of the society?
I think most of the people would have been the children of the farming, or the grandchildren of farmers. Some of the parents may have been first generation professionals and tradespeople. So I think a lot most would have probably come from the lower middle class, if you want to put it that way. So they were still in the socially mobile movement, as it were. There was a significantly earlier on, Jamaica had opened up, a bursaries to allow more people to come into teaching, and there were a group of older persons who were in teaching who got an opportunity with a bursary to come in and get a degree. So you did have a group of older students who did have that opportunity. So these were the type of people.
So you're not talking largely about 18-year-olds, young 20s making
No,
up this four room of 400.
you would have had those people as well, but I'm just making the point that a lot of these people, whether they're younger or older, were people who were in the aspect of social mobility, who are moving forward. If you remember, certainly in my time, when I was leaving primary school, getting a scholarship into high school, it was very limited. There are a limited amount of scholarships in Jamaica. So it was the cream of the crop. I'm not claiming to be, but you had to take an exam and to get into high school. Otherwise, people would have to pay. So it was. The number of schools then were mainly grammar schools, which were really church schools, and so I speak of social mobility, but these were people who had a special opportunity in the system, right? I mean, after 65 into the 70s, with your free education system, the thing opened up and the university expanded dramatically, and now you have children of carpenters, children of people from Coronation Market, and a wider scope of persons now have the opportunity, to have education. So there has been an opening up, so to speak, of the system, So that time, it was the kind of first level of the movement of the opening up of education, but that hadn't come yet, But still, those people were in a position of privilege, both in terms of their background and the training. And also, in that time, there was, as I said, the whole movement of the 50s. We still had the consciousness of the national movement in Jamaica. There was the Black Power movement and all of that at the time in the 60s, And you had the Workers' Party of Jamaica. Well, it wasn't formed yet, but the people were formed that. A lot of our young politicians probably were in that chapter too, even in the Manley era, And the people who were writers about the economy of Jamaica and our economic history may well have been in that chapel service as well,
there you heard the man, E. Anthony Allen. He is a psychiatrist here in Jamaica, does a whole host of things. And we had such a beautiful conversation. I am going to bring him back. So he'll be here for a part two, hopefully next week. Yes, he'll be here for a part two. And then we'll be talking about the progress that Jamaica has made subsequent to the visit of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1965, June 20, 1965, when he addressed that class, he addressed that valedictory class in 1965. We want to talk